Welcome to the True Falls Film Festival.
Welcome to the True Falls podcast, presented by KBIA. I'm Allison Kofelt. In this episode, we'll be listening to a conversation between True Falls' Paul Sturtz and Dora Garcia, who's the director of the film Segunda Vez. Segunda Vez will play at True Falls 2019. The film is anchored in happenings, which are part performance art pieces, part social experiments, created by Oscar Masoda. Masoda was a theorist and psychoanalyst from Argentina, and he was influential in morphing the artistic landscape of Buenos Aires in the 1960s. Masoda brought the theories of French psychoanalyst Jacques Lacan to the Spanish-speaking world. He died in 1979. Garcia's film repeats the happenings he staged decades ago and uses repetition and time to give a window into this period in Argentinian history. Here's Paul Sturtz.
At True False, we review a lot of what I would call biopics, you know, films that are about people. And most of the time, they're very straightforward. And I think you know exactly what I mean. You know, they rely on interviews and archival footage, you know, interviews with people who knew the celebrity or the important person, perhaps some footage of that person being interviewed. And you've obviously gone a very, very different way with this film. Would you consider this film to be a biopic of a certain kind of an intellectual Oscar Masoda?
Yeah, it's not. The film is actually not meant to. You won't know a lot about Oscar Masoda if you see the film. Since the beginning, the idea, so the Oscar Masoda is understood as a sort of, a crossroads, a kind of character that you can use to speak about the things he was interested in, which are the same as I was interested in. So he's a kind of, I don't know, how could you call a crossroads, a kind of a talisman, a kind of a red thread, something that you, a guide. Someone that you can hold as a guide to lead you into very complex passageways and very complex labyrinths, which are said like the psychoanalysis, performance, and politics, the labyrinth of the history in Argentina. How does it relate to psychoanalysis? How does that relate to the history of performance or of happening? So it is really a kind of a guy through a very complex network of things, and through the from that some information about himself, of course, surfaces.
It sounds like you didn't know very much about him until a little while before you started to make the film. How did you get introduced to his work?
Yeah, so first time I heard his name was in 2014. I started the film in 2015. It was through an Argentinian writer, Ricardo Piglia, and I was in Buenos Aires exhibiting in an exhibition in the Torquato di Tella, and then we had an interview, a kind of a public talk. In this public talk, he knew about my interest in psychoanalysis and performance, and then he said, well, if you are interested in that, then you certainly should be interested in Oscar Masoda, and that was the first time I heard that name. But that is often happens when you all begin to be interested in something, then all of a sudden, everything was about Oscar Masoda. Everybody, it turns out that he had died in Barcelona, not far from where I live. Turned out that some people I knew had known him, and it actually turned out that I knew his daughter, which I never thought it was his daughter. So all these kind of coincidences, you know, it really thought that it was really meant to happen. But mostly the moment of, let's say, when you really, you could compare it to falling in love or kind of saying, well, you can't get out of here anymore unless you make the film. It was when I read his text.
Can I assume that he's outside of, say, maybe psychotherapy? Perhaps he's not that well known in most parts of the world. He was important as a psychotherapist in Argentina and maybe as an artist in Spain and Argentina. But like, can you give me a gauge of like if you talk to a typical person in Spain, would they know his name?
No. No, it's a very unknown person. So his life, you could divide in three decades. 50s, when he was a literary critic. 60s, when he was a contemporary art critic and occasional artist. And the 70s, when he was a psychoanalyst. So in the 70s, that's when he, because of the Argentinian dictatorship, he went to Spain. And in Spain, he brought Lacan. And that's the part where he's most better known, where he's most famous. So every psychoanalyst knows Masota. At least every Spanish-speaking psychoanalyst knows Oscar Masota. But they totally ignore his other lives. They have no idea that he has a relation to our contemporary art. They certainly have no idea that he has a relation to a literary critic. And the other parts are really for the happy few. They're really for a very, very small group of people who really revere him, have a big admiration for him. But, you know, there's a, it really could compare as a kind of poème maudit, like this kind of character that has influenced many artists, but they are the other artists who are known and not him. So it is this kind of, this sort of figure.
I can see why your friend thought that this subject was your sweet spot. I mean, you described that your interests are performance, psychoanalysis, and politics, and it seems like this is where it all comes together. So could you, about midway through the film, there's a title card, and it talks about Masota. When the dictatorship comes around, Masota decides to not mount these happenings anymore, and he's very apologetic about it, but, you know, he says, you know, amidst all this turmoil, you know, he kind of lost his nerve to do these pieces. But it was in his mind even more important than ever before. I'm wondering if you could sort of relate that to sort of the contemporary situation. It seems like, you know, there are a lot of right-wing autocrats that have been springing up all over the world right now, you know, from Brazil with Bolsonaro and Erdogan in Turkey and Duterte in Philippines, Putin and Trump and Modi in India and Xi Jinping and Orban in Hungary. It just seems like what you're talking about right in this film is very, very cutting edge. You know, how do artists exists and put work out and the dangers that they face in doing their work. I'm wondering how much of the contemporary situation sort of informed the film in that way.
Yes, this is a kind of unsolvable question that was going on at the time of Masota and is still going on today. What is the responsibility of the artist or of the intellectual, let's say? What is the responsibility of the intellectual in times of political urgency? And most at that time, and still to the, at that time, let's say, at that time, the idea was if you really engage in politics, if you really a person who cares about let's say the terrible state of affairs in politics, then you should stop being an artist or being intellectual and just take your gun and go to fight. That was the position of the left. At the same time, if that was not possible for whatever reason, at least you should devote your art to disseminate the message of the left, let's say, to propaganda, to turn your work into propaganda. And so there were people like intellectuals like Masota or Cortázar or Macedonio, the three of them, and many others, of course, who thought that actually this was quite of problematic or paradoxical, because most of the art that was being produced as agitprop is a good name for it, more like a kind of engaged art, it was very formally was very conservative, it was very conventional, and so to them you could only do true revolutionary art, and it was a bit the position of the original avant-garde in the 20s and 30s. You could only do transmit revolution when your work was revolutionary as well in the form, in the way it was constructed. So they thought that the way of an intellectual to be responsible in times of political urgency was to produce even more work, to be able to transmit this sense of urgency in the artistic work or the intellectual work that you were producing. So that's what Masota is transmitting, and that was what Cortázar was transmitting in his famous essay, "Literature, the Revolution in Literature, and Literature in the Revolution." So this is a bit this kind of position that. When you translate it to today and the notion of socially engaged art, this gives you a lot of food for thought or things to, how you say, matter to think about, because one wonders how many paradoxes are in what is called socially engaged art. And I'm not against the concept per se, but I believe that the contradictions between socially engaged art, the idea of market, the idea of working with a system of conventional system of art distribution, they are too, fragrant. I don't know if that's English. Sometimes I cannot find the English word. They are too strong to pretend that it is an easy path. It is just a path that is too complicated, too complex, and those paradoxes should be acknowledged by intellectuals.
So the form that you've attained with this film is the opposite of conventional. So I feel like you've absorbed that sort of desire to make a revolutionary, very unconventional film, something that doesn't feel typical in any way, in the way that you're, you know, trying to, you know, create a very urgent, immediate kind of rendering of these ideas rather than, you know, the typical way of doing that. I'm wondering, you know, how you came to the right percentage of, you know, handholding, you know, giving context and leading the viewer through these ideas in a very clear way, and, you know, being evocative and sort of leaving little gaps that the audience would need to fill in, so that, you know, you weren't spelling out every idea in a very clear way. I think it's a very tricky balance to get to. Yeah. And I'm sure that every step along the way, you had to think about how far you wanted the audience to come towards the film and how far the film should go towards the audience. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, that is indeed the difficulty of it. Not only that, but also another big question was how much people who don't know anything about this care about. So it's a very, almost like a niche subject, a very specific thing. And then you wonder why someone who, I don't know, from England or from Poland or from the States would care about these Argentinian things, even people who don't speak the language. And they somehow, this is so far away. Why should you care about this complicated historical and complicated things? So indeed how to make it general and at the same time, let's say, not selling out, making of it a complete, spelling it out completely. So this was a very, very complex thing. And of course, it's a product of teamwork, the solution that we managed to give. So on the one hand, you had me that has independently filmed the 5 chapters, and who knew at that time after 4 years, I was a kind of knew everything about it, everything about Masota, everything about the times in Argentina, everything about years in Barcelona. And then you also have a production house, and really needed help to do the editing of all this material. So it was really a discussion between these three elements: the production, the editor, the film editor, and myself. And then we did even two sessions with a guest to see the edits. So we had this kind of screenings with very different people. Some people who knew a lot, some people who didn't know anything at all, people who could understand the languages, people who did not understand any of the languages. And then from those feedback, we kept constructing the film. So it was really a teamwork. I would never have been able to make myself alone this edit.
Coming up after the break, TrueFalse co-founder Paul Sturtz and director Dora Garcia discuss how she conceived of time in Segunda Vez.
But it is actually fundamental that you don't ellipse that time, that you really, the audience actually is sharing a real time moment with what is happening.
But first, a word from our sponsor. Hey, listeners, it's Allison, letting you know that this episode of the True False podcast is brought to you by the University of Missouri. And that is, in fact, where we are sitting right now in the KBIA studios at the University of Missouri School of Journalism. We're here with Ryan Vermeulener, news director for KBIA and assistant professor of journalism. And he is going to tell us a little bit about the Missouri Method. Hey.
Hey, what's up?
Nothing. Just want to know about the Missouri Method. What is that?
So anytime you ask a journalism professor here about that, they always use analogies for it. And one of my favorite ones that someone at the Missouri in the newspaper that operates the journalism school said
once
was...
Oh, you got a newspaper.
Yeah, we got a newspaper and a TV station, radio station. But this newspaper editor was like, it's kind of like you're an air traffic controller, but none of the pilots have their licenses. Because we cut students loose. We just let them go crazy in actual professional newsrooms. And when I go to public radio conferences and tell them that we have 70 to 100 journalism students working in our newsroom as reporters, anchors, show hosts, producing podcasts like this one you're listening
like
to right
one.
Now.
Yeah.
These people look at me like I'm crazy because they're like, you give that kind of control to people that you don't know if you can trust. And it's like, yeah, we do. And it's kind of like, you push the bird out of the nest, right? And yes, lots of them do fall flat on the ground, and that's fine, and that's part of it. And I'd rather them fall flat on the ground here than out in the world.
True.
But a lot of them fly, right? And they do. We've had students win national professional awards competing against professionals for stories that they've done here. Yeah, as students.
Yeah.
And they win all the student awards. They win, like, all the student awards, too. But even professional awards, Edward R. Murrow Awards, students have them on their resume before they leave here at the University of Missouri. It's crazy.
Welcome back to the True False podcast, presented by KBIA. I'm Allison Kofeld. Let's return to Paul Sturtz's conversation with Dora Garcia on her film Segunda Vez, which will play at the 2019 True False Film Fest. The film explores the repeated happenings, these part performance art pieces, part social experiments of Oscar Masoda. Garcia creates happenings in Segunda Vez. Often in the film, we, the audience, view an audience on screen as they experience a happening.
It seems like there's this balance between the film, and this probably won't sound very good, but there's something very, very exciting and immediate about the film. And then there's something quite dull as well that you've included, which is the waiting room aspect of the mm-hmm. film. There's a lot of waiting mm-hmm. for the happenings to happen, or the anti-happenings to happen, or in the last chapter, I think, which takes place in a waiting room, actually, outside mm-hmm. of an interrogation. Could you talk a little bit about your desire to include this material, which is about anticipating something about to happen? How did that figure into what you wanted to accomplish with the film?
Yes, well, I can say two things here. One is that one of my strongest cinematic experiences was Jean Dilmanque du Commerce, the Chantal from Chantal Ackerman, by Chantal Ackerman. And I was always very shocked in this film. There's a certain moment when the protagonist, Jean Dilmanque, has miscalculated the time. And she's 10 minutes too early. And so she has to wait 10 minutes. And then I was fascinated that she sits down and we wait 10 minutes with her. And she doesn't do anything but waiting. And I was really fascinated. And I always have kept this image of me, the notion of when you include the notion of real time in movies, this notion that actually when you don't do ellipse, so this idea of the ellipse, this is also something which, again, another it's very important, for instance, in a performance, what is called video performance. So when you do document a performance, you are not worried about entertaining the audience, or you are not worried about making the whole thing an enjoyable experience, but you're worried about documenting in a very faithful way the time that took a certain action. So from these two sources, let's say the tradition of performance, video performance, and this tradition coming from experimental cinema about this notion of really reflecting time in the same way in a relation of one-one to reality, this is something I have always enjoyed to do in the films I have made, and I haven't made many, but I was always very much having this present. And then when you're confronted with the text of Cortázar, the waiting is absolutely fundamental. It's the whole story is in this waiting, in the idea of that you don't know what is happening. And actually, for the experimented observer, there's always time. There are always things going on. It is almost, as I say, when you are in a waiting room and you pay attention to everything that is going on, you still can see that there are things going on behind the door. You still can follow the conversation that is going in the middle room. But it is actually fundamental that you don't ellipse that time, that you really, the audience actually is sharing a real time moment with what is happening. So that's why even if it's filmed with three cameras, this is a real time, it's actually film theater. So the filming takes exactly the time that it took for the actors to go through a very realistic representation of an encounter like that would be. And so that was something that for me was, we could not cheat with that. I could not cheat with that. I could not try to make it more eventful.
So I wanted to just shift a little bit. You definitely are playing with the idea of repetition. It's not only in the title of the film, but it's also woven through the material. Could you talk about the significance of repeating for the film Segunda Vez? What does it mean?
Yeah, well, the act of repetition has multiple meanings in the film. On the one hand, there is the meaning of Cortázar, meaning somehow that the coming back to a certain place means actually death. It means annihilation. So there is, let's say, this structure of terror, where you can anticipate when you are told to come back in 3 days, you can already anticipate what is going to happen, and yet you can't stop it. So that's one of the meanings. Another meaning, of course, is the idea of repetition as learning process. So these happenings of Masota were done a second time by me in order to learn how they were constructed and in order to show them to people. So they were both repetitions in the sense of a theater play, which is repeated every time it's presented. But it is also, of course, a film set in the sense that it had to be repeated in order to be documented or in order to be filmed. And then you have a more philosophical meaning of repetition in which, let's say, a philosophical and historical. One thing is, of course, this idea that those who don't know history are forced to repeat it. What we are seeing now, and now much, much worse than when the film was edited, is actually the raising again of fascism with a, how you say, a shamelessness that was unthinkable 10 years ago. That's what has changed, is that fascism was not there, but the shameless in which fascism, Bolsonaro is saying that he is, how you say, nostalgic of the dictatorship and that they should not only torture but kill people. The president of the democratic countries saying things like that. So this kind of repetition or historic repetition is mixed with the idea of the prophetic character of Masota happening and how these things are happening again, and therefore the prophecy is being accomplished once more. And finally, there is a more philosophical notion of repetition, which is more like the kind of Kierkegaard Nietzschean notion of repetition, in which the fact that you repeat something that happened in the past, it means that you're not only putting it in the present, it means that you're also projecting it into the future. And then you're placing it into some sort of a no time. So it's like by repeating these events, we are kind of entering into a sort of eternal return structure, which is something kind of atemporality, something that I was interested in the film. That was also why I didn't make any effort to try to, to pretend that we were in the 70s, no effort at all in costumes, no effort at all in elements that were clearly impossible to be in the 70s, like computers, for instance. So I really wanted that these things were happening again, like into a sort of a haunted house logic.
I'm wondering, you immersed yourself so thoroughly in this other time and place, you know, that's... you know, around 50 years ago, this very revolutionary time in the world in the 60s and into the 70s. And I'm wondering, was it disappointing to you to sort of come out of this research mode of being in this other time and then realizing perhaps the time that we're living in right now doesn't have quite the same amount of political fervor and excitement, or maybe I'm misreading the time that we're in?
Well, I think there's certainly not a lack of political fervor now. I am very much aware of the desperate situation we are in and the need to act. So there's a call for action, but I mean, in my circuit or in the people I know, there is plenty of action. I do think that we are in a very politically very, very active moment. It is just sort of discouraging how active it is as well on the totalitarian side or in the fascist proto-fascist side. I believe there is a parallelism between the two moments. And at the same time, we have to be very much aware that it's a completely different moment. So, for instance, one of the most dangerous and more puzzling things is how experts, let's say the international fascists, and I'm thinking here of this kind of Judeo-Christian empire of Steve Bannon, how smart they are using media, how much social media that was once considered to be a tool of liberation to get over, you know, for people to get together, like it was in the Arab Spring, for instance, it actually has turned completely the other way around, and it is used to divide, misinform and deactivate people. So things are different and it's a very exciting moment. And I think that it is really this film and other films and other projects that I'm occupied with is really a call for action, but very much on the tradition of Masota in the role of the intellectual should have. So it's still a need for new forms and new formats that have to produce this effect.
That's it for this episode of the True False podcast. You can find more of our conversations with filmmakers at kbia.org, on iTunes, or wherever you get your podcasts. Leave a review if you can. It would help more people find the show. Thanks to Paul Sturtz and Dora Garcia for the interview. This episode was produced by Trevor Hook, with editing by Janet Saidi and Sebastian Martinez. A special thanks to Betsy Smith. Our music was created by Tim Pilcher using sounds from the True False Film Fest. Hopefully we'll see you at True False 2019, February 28th through March 3rd in downtown Columbia, Missouri. I'm Allison Kofeld. Thanks for listening.